If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Tom Gimbel's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Why are you writing about how to hire when your company is embroiled in controversy? Not your company, right, Tom?
No, not my company, John. I think what ends up happening is companies, whether they're doing a massive layoff or maybe there's problems with the CEO, i.e. Theranos from a few years ago out in Silicon Valley, or there's a criminal problem or a security breach and that type of stuff, cybersecurity breach, that there is usually going to come a time when a company, if it's around long enough, has challenges that the external world knows about. And too often I see people who work at that company scared or embarrassed in how to hire people. And I think that, you know, what one person calls a tragedy, another person calls an opportunity, to quote the former mayor Rahm Emanuel, never waste a good tragedy. And you can use that to your advantage when hiring people.
How so?
Well, a lot of people want to be part of fix-ups. A lot of people want to be busy. A lot of people want to be there when the company goes, you know, it's kind of like a sports team. Do you want to join a championship team and you're just a cog in the machine? Or do you want to be there when it goes from not being a playoff contender to winning the Super Bowl? And it's the same thing in corporate America. If you want to join a team or a company that's underperforming and you have the ability to help grow revenue, to build a new culture, to be a part of that, you're going to be viewed very positively and favorably when it comes to bonuses, reviews, raises, more responsibility. It's an easier way to grow.
So the way Theo Epstein saw the Cubs, maybe somebody should see the White Sox right now. Say, why do I want to be in that office? But wait a minute, this is how much worse can it get? This is a real opportunity,
yeah,
huh?
Exactly. If they promote the guy that's running the minor league teams and they say, well, it's just somebody who was part of the bad history, why would I want to go work there? And the answer is because if you can turn around the minor league system, then you're going to be part of something really special. So it's really an opportunity. It's how you sell it. And it's no different than real estate. And somebody says that the house is a piece of junk and somebody else says it's a great fixer-upper and a great location. And it's all what we make it to be, but we've got to control our mind shift.
You know what I think is analogous to this is buying a stock when it's low.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you got to look at something for what it is and why a company. But so when a company hires a new CEO, a lot of times you'll see a bump in the stock because somebody's going to bring new ideas to it. And or if they hire a new chief sales officer or a new finance person. Mm-hmm. And so those are the types of things of what real analysts do is they study the company, what the changes are, where they are in the market niche. And if you're going to take a new job at a company and you go to Google that knocks the cover off the ball and has $1 billion in profits every year, what impact do you make? But if you go to a company that's trending downward or has been in a little bit of a slump and you can grow it, A, you're going to make more money, but B, you're going to be in the standpoint of really being an influential player in that team.
I get that, but I also think if we just stuck with the stock market analogy, make sure the fundamentals are there, right? Like maybe the reason that company is having trouble is because it's a bad place to be. I'm thinking about, say, Twitter. I wonder if you had an opportunity to go work for Twitter, would you say, yeah, that's a company I want to be part of? Or would you say, you know what, I just don't think that's a safe bet because, you know, it's not just a stock I'm buying. It's my career here. It's where I'm going to live. It's my future. So, you know,
Twitter's a little bit of an anomaly, I think, in this. But I get what you're saying. But I'll give you there was a company in Chicago where the CEO was literally murdered and in the office. And a lot of people were like, well, I don't want to go there. It's terrible. I'm like, wait a second. Like, I get that something terrible happened, but that doesn't mean that the place is a bad place to work. And in fact, the company had a great product offering, they had great employees, and there was this stigma of a dark cloud over it because of this horrible tragedy. But the opportunity to go there when other people who were there were scared, Some of them quit because of it. So now there's an opportunity to go in there and make an impact and really be part of the new company, not the old company.
Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network, says look for these opportunities to grow. LaSalleNetwork.com. Okay, Tom, always interesting conversation and thoughts. Thanks for your help today.
It's not always sunsets and rainbows, John. You got to go find your own.
I hear you. Is he signing off each week now with a new kind of aphorism or clever saying? Tom, that's the challenge for you now. This is WGN's Wintrust Business Lunch. Max Adams is a senior editor overseeing markets coverage at Business Insider. What an interesting and kind of gloomy idea here, but one to talk about for a few minutes. It's called the doom loop. Hey, Max, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
What's the doom loop?
Right. So, yeah, the doom loop is really a term and a concept that that economists have been throwing around a lot lately. Really, since it became pretty clear that remote work was going to have some staying power and that the percentage of people working from home was going to continue to be a lot higher than pre-COVID era, even as employers push return to office plans on their workforce. So there are various estimates out there, but I think most point to around 20 to 25% of workers being hybrid remote and something like 12% are fully remote. So that's a lot lower than the pandemic peak, but it's much higher than pre-COVID. So the general theory or the idea of the doom loop is just one of urban economic decline that says basically that at the core of many cities is their central business district, the place where everyone works. And as people stop going into the office and commuting and patronizing businesses around their workplace, the economy of a city can wither and decay, really. And everything from restaurants to small businesses to public transportation is at risk here as people spend less money in the cities that they work in.
You know, I think we've often talked about that on this show, or I've thought about it in those terms. Yeah, I get that. But then I didn't think about what's the next layer or level of that. And it's, well, these successful businesses, say the building owners, collect revenue. They have to pay taxes on that revenue that would go to the city. But without that revenue to the city, now the city core declines. That's the loop, right?
Right. So that's the next chapter of this, really, is the real estate component and the property values and then ultimately the taxes. So, basically this is what my colleague Jennifer Sore was writing about this week. We wrote about an economist who's looking at it through this lens specifically. And the thinking is that basically employers have less need for their office space. They'll renew at lower rates in terms of the space they require. And landlords are just going to be sitting on a lot of empty office property, which means that the value goes down. But then what happens after that, the tax implications for the cities dealing with this are potentially pretty dire. So cities generate a lot of money from these commercial property taxes. I don't have the figures for Chicago in front of me, but New York, for instance, New York City took in $7 billion in 2021 from office property taxes alone. So it's a huge amount. And basically, as the property values decline, these taxes will probably get reassessed lower to reflect that. And generally, there's just less going into the coffers of these cities.
Well, is there any hope that the other uses of these buildings will offset some of that? Residential, recreational, event spaces? I mean, those buildings aren't necessarily all going to come down. The idea has been to repurpose them. What's the expectation there?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest hope, and I think that there's been several suggestions for everything from mixed use retail to convert these offices into residential. You know, I think that would also kind of go towards alleviating some of the housing issues in the country. You know, the U.S. has a housing shortage. Any amount that comes online can help contribute to sort of alleviating that a bit, but. That's not super easy. I think for the landlords and the owners of these properties, that's pretty expensive.
Yeah.
And these conversions are costly, and there's no guarantee that people are going to necessarily flock to the places that that they once sort of worked in to live. So I think it's a bit of a gamble.
Right. If they don't want to go downtown to work, maybe they don't want to go downtown to live. And, the joke has been, but we need more pickleball courts. So let's do that. And anecdotally, we've seen that happen. But again, I don't see that as some sort of fix for this. But I wonder if we'll be wrong that we're really only operating on an experience that's 3 years old. I wonder if in 5 years or 10 years, in fact, it'll be more like 99% of the business districts will be full again of business people. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. And I think that, that employers are certainly pushing their workforces to get back to the office. I think industries like law and finance are basically 100% back in the office. And I think it's a matter of time before we see other large, you know, employers pushing for their workforces to be back, you know, 100% in person. So I think there's a possibility that, that the doom loop is avoided. And I think that it's possible that, you know, office property values recover and this kind of like dire theory doesn't play out the way yeah. some economists are sort of fearing.
Sure. But if I was the mayor, I wouldn't bet on that. Right. Like I hope that the people in City Hall have a plan B or a plan C, because obviously all things are leading to exactly what you're talking about. Are municipalities planning about that? Is San Francisco thinking hard about this, and Chicago, et cetera?
I mean, I don't have specific sort of, you know, anecdotes insights into their plans, but I would imagine they have to be. I mean, the office districts in these cities are so crucial to the economies of, of these places. So I think they have to be planning with business owners and landlords to figure out, you know, some solution to possibly repurpose this space in the event that that workers don't come back in, in full capacity the way people are saying.
Max Adams is a senior editor overseeing markets coverage at Business Insider. Oh, this is interesting. I'm not loving this, but I'm glad we're talking about this. Max, thanks for your insight today.
Thank you so much for having me.
By the way, about property taxes going away because some of the businesses are no longer collecting rents downtown, and is there a doom loop out there? Hey, John Williams, as property taxes on commercial property are likely to decrease, it's likely that residential property taxes will increase. It's a zero-sum game. Yeah, I wondered about that. Even if they convert those business buildings to residential, Dennis Rodkin's in our studio. Hear me out on this, Dennis. This is your beat. Our last guest was talking about how if the core places and cities no longer have people coming downtown, we're going to lose the rents. And that's not just bad for the landlords. Now, the billions of dollars that those rents throw off to the city is lost. Now, the city can't keep up with the downtowns. And if you don't keep up with the downtowns, then businesses are less likely to want to go downtown. And now you've got this doom loop. And if you say, okay, but if it's residential, I don't know that the residential property taxes would cover what they're losing. I don't know who pays a higher tax on that.
Well, the far larger proportion is paid by commercial.
Really?
Because, these are the value of a high rise is the value of hundreds of individual homes.
Right. But I mean, So if you took a business in downtown and converted it to residential spaces, you'd maybe have more taxable units. You might actually throw off more property taxes.
I'm sure that's a possibility.
If the real estate were converted that way. But then you've still got to sell those units. You've still got to get people to come downtown. Dennis Rodkin's here, the residential real estate reporter at Cranes. What is the market like for condos in the city of Chicago generally?
It hasn't been great. It has been sagging longer than I expected. In fact, it was sort of early summer 2022 when I was writing, the condo market is back, because it had been so beaten in 20 and 21 and early 2022. But it has come back. There are sales, but it's just not what it once was. I recently did a story on the continuing problem of condos selling at below their previous purchase price. The most outrageous example I have is one where the family bought it in 2005 for $4.5 million, and they sold it this summer for $2.5 million, losing. A potential, losing $2 million. This was an estate sale, so it's not that money came out of somebody's pocket, but it's still, there are dozens of those on my chart, on the spreadsheet I keep. Bought it for $600 10 years ago, sold it for $400, those kinds of things. The downtown condo market, people are still buying, but they are typically buying at lower prices than ever before.
Mm. Price probably has to be a little lower right now, too, because money costs so much more right now as well.
And money costs so much more. I don't know if you saw, but I did a story this week about a developer who had bought some 19th century row houses on Elm, sort of near the Whole Foods in the Gold Coast. He bought three in a row with a plan to take them all down, put up 12 condos. They would have been about million two condos. He bought them in 2019, 20, and 21, and he now has them back on the market because he said people aren't going to buy condos. The price, the monthly payment on these condos would have gone from the $6,000 range to the $9,000 range by the doubling of interest rates that happened in 2022. And it is true that a lot of people buying in the $1.2 million range are buying with a mortgage. People like to say,
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so the monthly cost really would make
I thought the higher end of the market was still pretty strong, that the most expensive buildings, maybe because they were cash buyers or...
Well, but John, $1 million is not the higher end of the market in Chicago.
Maybe I'm not talking about that. Yeah. Is that true, though? Is the higher end of the market still pretty solid? The, I don't know, $10 million, $5 million units?
You know, I just wrote about a $16 million sale in Lake Geneva, a $3 million sale in Lakeview, but that uppermost stratum from $4 million and up, which I've been tracking year in and year out, we're running less than half the number of sales at that level that we had last year, that we had in 2022.
Yeah, I believe that too.
Running close to about 2019 numbers.
Speaking of what does $1 million get you these days, what wisdom do you have for us on the city's plan to increase the transfer of a title, the tax on that, on units over $1 million and $1.5 million? If you're selling less than that, you're actually going to pay less, although the seller's going to pick up some of the difference. But I don't know, what do you have to say about all that?
If this goes through, as proposed in the last few weeks, it does sound like it's more palatable to people because I'm a seller under $1 million. I actually get a tax break, or it's really a fee break. Even though this is called the transfer tax, I pay it only once, so we really ought to call it a fee. I will pay a lower fee if I'm selling under $1 million, and I'm only going to pay a slightly higher fee at just above $1 million, and then it's the really high-end properties that pay even more. So I think that makes it more palatable. It makes it feel more like it's really taxing the people that can most afford to pay it. But it still does mean that if I'm buying a $2, $3, $4 million condo, I may be stretching to do that. I'm not here to defend the wealthy, but people who are buying $2, $3, and $4 million condos are often stretching to do so. And when you add this fee to it, that may have an effect on the ultimate sale price. And so we may see down the line that upper end of the market sags a little bit, that people, you know, the total I'm willing to pay goes down because that fee is factored in, that larger fee is factored in.
And the threshold is $1.5 million, yeah, where you really see a jump. And so David Hochberg was in here talking to us about this the other day, and while he and I kind of got a little agitated at each other, and I think we were a little confused about the details, I do understand the point, too, that if you're buying a $10 million building, that's a business investment. This is a core part of the business of Chicago that is now going to have to pay a much higher. If it's a $20 million building, you're looking at another $40 million.
Right.
$400,000.
And that has to go into the rents that I can pull out of the building from my tenants.
Or it's going to diminish considerably the purchase price of the thing. But either way, people are either going to suffer on the selling end, or it's just going to make it unpalatable. People don't want to pay that kind of a fee just to transfer the title from one business to another. So
it's also true that very high end, the residential buyers who are buying these $5, $8, $10 million penthouses, they have the money to go somewhere else if they want. And the example I use many times is a guy several years ago sold a $10 million house in Winnetka. And I got him on the phone and he said, you know, I was planning to put $5 million into a Chicago condo and $5 million into a mansion in, say, Boca Raton in Florida. This is pre-COVID. This is probably 6-7 years ago. But Illinois' financial situation was already tough. We're already wondering about tax increases because of pensions and things like that. And he said, I figured out it's better for me to put the whole 10 in a mansion in Boca Raton It's an investment that will perform faster, that will appreciate faster, and I'll just stay at the Four Seasons when I come to Chicago. Now, these are numbers that, of course, 9 out of 10 or 99 out of 100 of your listeners can't really relate to, but my point is that very high-end people actually look at where their money's going very, very carefully, and they may say, I'm not going to buy a place in Chicago just on the principle of not wanting to pay that higher transfer tax.
Hello, Mr. Griffin. But
Exactly.
Okay, but is it also just maybe the focus is wrong if you think, well, the rich people, blah blah blah. Imagine business people who are buying buildings, and they're not going to live in a $10 million condo, but they're going to buy a $10 million building with $2,500,000 units.
Yeah.
And now they got to bite it for, and the administration sees this as, here's the sell. 94% of the buildings or the units that sell, the transactions in Chicago, are less than $1 million.
Right.
So really, it's a transfer of the burden from the 94% of us to the 6% of them. And that politically sounds savvy, but you might be cutting off your nose because we're talking about these businesses.
Because that 6% is people who fund political campaigns, people who are donors to campaigns.
Or are just good business people trying to make a living. And it's not a rich guy always. It's a businessman who has some capital, but he's in the business of residences, of condos.
Yeah.
And now you're asking him to bear a greater burden of it. And so that's the give and take, I think, on the political scene.
But the thing about the political side is, while it is only a minority of people, a slim, tiny, little bitty minority of people who would have to pay this higher transfer tax, the great majority, if this becomes a referendum, if this is put on the ballot, the great majority will say, I'm not going to have to pay that tax, and I think we do need to solve homelessness problems in the city.
Right.
So I think they will vote in favor of it in large part, thinking it's never going to touch me. Of course I want you, somebody else, to pay for it.
And maybe that's smart, too. I mean, 94% of the people won't necessarily be directly affected by it, and maybe the money will actually help the problem. But I guess that's the yin and the yang of it. It's 12:46. Let's pause for a minute. Dennis Rodkin's in our studio. We haven't even gotten to the reason I asked you to come in here, but it's always interesting talking real estate with Dennis Rodkin. Let's get you a business minute now with Don Kleppen.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Sterling Bay is proposing another 29-story apartment building in Fulton Market, just a few blocks from another one that's currently wrapping up construction. The developer's planning a 390-unit apartment tower at 370 North Carpenter Street in the trendy former Meatpacking District. Northwestern and the University of Chicago have moved up in PitchBook's annual ranking of MBA programs for producing founders of venture-backed companies. Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management jumped to 6th place from 9th, just ahead of U of C's Booth School of Business. That jumped to 7th from 11th place last year. And ketchup enthusiasts rejoice, you can now paint your home the color of your favorite condiment. Heinz superfans will be lining up to order red HTK57, a limited edition paint color now available for sale through British home decor site Lick. The project was led by The Kitchen, the in-house agency for Chicago-based Kraft Heinz. It's available exclusively at Lick.com, but they've only made 570 tins of the matte paint, so you'll have to hurry. That's your Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Don Kleppen.
Here's the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and I'm going to steal one of Bob Surratt's morning show bits, Name That TV Tune, after I thank the Chevy Silverado HD for sponsoring us. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, name this TV tune. It's a trick question because the TV show I'm talking about today does not have a theme song. The Bear has been a hit for FX and Hulu and for a bunch of Chicago restaurants, including Ever, the Michelin-starred fine dining restaurant in the West Loop in Fulton Market. Season 2, Episode 7 featured Richie, one of the characters in the ragtag group of people trying to convert a Mr. Beef-style joint into a fine dining restaurant. He is sent to Ever to be an intern, a stage, as they're called, where he learns how to polish forks and other attentions to detail. Michael Muser and his partner, Chef Curtis Duffy, opened Ever 3 years ago, and the restaurant was shut down for a week for filming. And how do you think Episode 7 turned out, Michael?
We were incredibly happy with it.
And that is your kitchen in the show?
It is, yeah. That's it's our kitchen. It's our dining room. Even the wait staff that you see in the episode, they use our wait staff. They use our cooks.
And the food that is shown?
There would be a moment in the script where they'd be like, and a plate of food gets dropped onto the table. And all of a sudden, you know, we're pretty invested. So we're like, well, what plate of food? What's that plate of food look like? My partner, the star of our show, Curtis Duffy, he plated all of the food and created all the dishes.
So has being on The Bear impacted your business?
Yeah. Once people got to episode 7, as they kind of binged the series, we saw it, heard it, and felt it. The impact of the show is great and positive, too, because people's, you know, everyone's reaction to the show has been really good, and especially episode 7.
And how about that scene where a diner was overheard by staff lamenting that she was going to have to leave Chicago without trying deep dish pizza, and Richie runs out to grab one, and she gets her pizza. Is that in line with reality?
It's 100% in line. Or just the other night, for example, we had a client. This is a good one, actually.
Oh, we're out of time for today, but Michael Muser of Ever will continue that story and share more about The Bear, season 2, episode 7, tomorrow. From the dairy farm to your belly, today's National Chocolate Milkshake Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Which of these stories is top of your mind, my friend? Is there one that's more pressing to you than another? Historic State Street towers. You wrote about the Justin Ishbia Winneka controversy. What's the latest on that plot?
That one's really interesting. Justin Ishbia is the man building a $77 million estate on the lakefront in Winnetka. I've been talking about this, other reporters have, for a couple of years. He bought 4 lakefront mansions in Winnetka, 3 in a row, then there's a park, then he bought a mansion, then there's a park. So there was this land swap arranged where he'd swap some parkland for that mansion. This turned out, it became really a mess for the Winnetka Park District, the municipality. So that is on hold. He still owns a mansion in between 2 parks. He's building on his properties south of those parks. But part of that land swap was arranged so that Winnetka could upgrade its beaches. And so what he did last week is an associate of his showed up at a Park District board meeting and said, I want to donate $3 million. He said, no strings attached, so that Winnetka can finish its beach improvements,
right,
regardless of the fact that I have this house landlocked between them. You can do your thing, and somewhere down the line, what he said to me is the land swap is dormant. Somewhere down the line, if it happens, then his property gets incorporated into this big buildup of the beaches in Winnetka. But what he wants to do is, the Park District has said it doesn't have enough to finish all the work, so he'd like to donate $3 million. This was announced at a meeting, at a comment-only part of the meeting, so I don't know what the Winnetka Park District is going to say, but I think down the line we'll hear them either say, no, we don't want it, we think there are strings attached, or yes, we do want it, and that would be the next story I'd write.
You wrote that he's worth $2.8 billion. Chicago private equity firm, Shore Capital Partners, that's him?
That's him.
So I guess he's got all the money that God has and needs. I don't understand people like this, though.
Co-owns the 2 basketball, with his brother who lives in Detroit, just bought the men's and women's basketball teams in Phoenix.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he has quite a bit of money. And it's interesting, you know, I have actually spoken to him on the phone for these stories, and he says, look, I get it. I'm rich and that makes me a target. People want various things out. But he also says, and I'm not his cheerleader, I'm just saying what he has told me. He says, I want to build an estate that, you know, my family really wants to live on in Winnetka. And, you know, that comes to $77 million.
Understood. And so if he wants to spend that money, that's $77 million somebody gets because he's paying people to build that estate.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
So maybe that's not necessarily wasted money, but it would seem to me like if I had all that much money and I could live in Winnetka and I could have the footprint of 3 mansions, that would scratch that itch for me, you know?
I wouldn't say,
yeah, but we really could use 4. That's the part I don't understand, but I'm not worth $3 billion or even 2.
You aren't?
Dennis, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, John.
Read Dennis Rodkin and Cranes.